We are joined by this week's guest on Addiction and Hour with Hour, and I don't mean megastar eponymous Dr. Michael Hour. I mean our guest, which is the Director of Research and Education from the International Center for Responsible Gaming, Travis Steinert. Travis, you're another in a long line of guests who could have really big business cards.
Yeah, I mean, it's squishing it all onto a little business card is difficult sometimes.
That's a lot. It is a lot. But, yeah.
Most people just go by ICRG, I think, for a reason.
I'm just going to read you this, right? We had a guy on the other podcast who's an author of this book. And he is the Joan and Erwin Jacobs Senior Program Officer for American Institution, Society, and the Public Good at the American Academy of Arts and Sciences.
What's the book called? Show it again.
It's called Losing Big, America's Reckless Bet on Sports Gambling. It's very good.
Okay. Wow.
But I just love his job title. I'm going to carry that with me to the grave. In fact, I might have it as my epitaph, which obviously I am not that person. I've never had that job, but I just love it. Sorry.
As LinkedIn is getting more and more popular and people are inflating their job titles, not to say that that was an inflated job title, but as job titles are getting longer and longer, I think we're going to see the end of business cards, and you'll just eventually scan people's phones, right? I mean, there's already some conferences where the apps are like that. You don't give out business cards anymore. I mean, having said that, I mean, business cards are still very big in Asia Pacific. You know, certain cultures really rely on the business cards, but I think, at least in North America, yeah, it's going the way of the dinosaur.
My bio on LinkedIn, I keep getting criticized for it because it just says I write and edit stuff. But, you know, it's true.
Truthful. Yeah, there you go.
Principle of parsimony, isn't it?
What does that? You're very quiet there, Michael. Are you pointing your face at your microphone?
Yeah, I do. I can bring it a bit closer.
But it's like education in real time on the podcast. Fucking where is it? Jesus Christ.
Yeah, it's huge. I mean, you forced me to buy it. It's this huge thing, you see.
See how clear his voice is now.
Is it better?
Yes.
Yeah, because before you always said I should put it as far away as possible because I have such a, you know, resonating voice like an...
I have
Pavarotti,
definitely never said that.
Pavarotti.
Yes, Michael. That's what everybody thinks when they meet you. Look at this. Look at this fat bearded buffoon.
Hey, no shaming here. No shaming. Okay, it's all about.
I can
voice.
Say that. I'm allowed to. I'm fat.
No, you're not. You're a bit roundish, like an egg.
Cheeky fuck. That's just patronizing. I'm a fat dude. Travis, what's your what does the International Center for Responsible Gaming do? What's your core?
So maybe a little bit of background about ICRG. So we were founded in 1996, and at its core, ICRG is sort of a leading non-for-profit organization dedicated to supporting peer-reviewed gambling research. Right, we've had I think over $50 million has been raised and invested into research since 1996. We have a global network of researchers, clinicians, regulators, operators, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, our ultimate mission is to really help individuals and families affected by gambling disorder prevent the onset of gambling problems through high quality scientific research, but most importantly, an evidence base, right? Like a solid evidence base of empirical literature that can be used as the foundation for education initiatives or RG programming, you know. Our hope is that the research that's produced through the research that we fund can influence policy, programs, initiatives, or at least, you know, change attitudes, behaviors, or rhetoric around things. So that's sort of that's the sales pitch of ICRG. But I think what makes us unique is that we are committed to the integrity of our research. So we're completely independent. So the research funding decisions are made by an independent scientific advisory board, which really protects the research from industry or funder influence. We have a very strict firewall policy so that the funder or the source of the funding never talks to the researchers or has an influence on the research or what research gets funded. So grantees, when they get it, must acknowledge the funding sources, and they can publish freely. We have no ICRG or the donors have no control over what gets published or when or to what extent it gets published. Sometimes to my chagrin, because I think everything that we do, we fund, should get published, but sometimes no results aren't the most publishable. But yeah, our firewall really ensures that donors can't influence the project selection, design, or publication. And then, and we've had, you know, ICRG funded studies have shaped, you know, RG programs, policy worldwide, diagnostics, those sorts of things. So happy to talk about, you know, our firewall or our, we have a research transparency statement on our website that really outlines all the steps that we take to ensure the integrity of our funded research. But I don't want to bore you with all of that.
I'm curious about one thing tied into what you've just been saying. And it's, so when you do research, so you've got a panel which says, here's what we're going to research, fuck off and spend the money kind of thing. You know, go and research it. But yeah, when you've done the research, is it just like, just put out into the world and hope for the best? I mean, because it's, I guess it's, one of the issues for anybody doing any kind of research is transparency of data sources, transparency of funding, and that kind of thing. And you know, in most studies, let's be fair, of the past century, you can find the bias by finding the source of funding. Now, as you have removed the link to funding, so I guess what I'm saying is that there's no sort of willing recipient of the study, if you like. So you've done the study and then you just put it out there.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, so two things about that. So the first is that our scientific advisory board has identified areas of interest. Like, for example, one of their areas of interest is in policy and policy changes. And so when a funder comes along who is typically, you know, industry or industry adjacent, that wants to provide money for research, they can either give it to us unrestricted, in which case it goes into, you know, our general pool to fund our open calls. We have large grants and seed grants. We try to do that on an annual basis. And so those can fund, you know, basically any topic, right? Researchers from around the world submit anything and everything to us that they want funded, any interesting topic. So the unrestricted funds typically go towards that sort of topic, the open grants, or they could choose from one of the topics that's sort of pre-selected, pre-vetted by our scientific advisory board. As I mentioned, one of those is around like policy differences internationally. And so that's where our recent call, we had a recent RFA, request for applications for research on the effects of policy in Brazil, right, to see what's going on there, because there's a lot happening sort of in the gambling landscape and trying to tell, like, what are the cultural differences? Has that impact RG policy? What can we learn from that? And that sort of things. And what are the obviously the knock-on effects on gambling harm? And so so there are willing recipients of the research more often than not. Not every industry personnel. And when you say industry, right, like, there's no such thing as the industry, right? You have a bunch of people in RG roles or different roles within different operators, different associations or organizations, and they all have a different concept and idea of what RG is or what RG means. We're the International Center for Responsible Gaming, and so I don't want to harp too much on language, but I'm also part of the Better Gambling Forum. Which I don't know if you, I think you talked to Vasilinki from the European Betting Association on a previous cast. She's also on the steering committee for the Better Gambling Forum. So this is an international, you can go to bettergamblingforum.org or com if you want to learn more. But we're all getting together, basically people from around the world, including industry, and we settled on the term player protection. And I actually like that. I like that a little bit more than responsible gaming or responsible gambling, because it implies, it sort of mirrors consumer protection laws in the sense of that players need to be protected, not only, you know, from an RG individual level, but from regulators, from the industry, from public health perspectives. Like, to me, that term is more of a wraparound approach that I kind of like player protection. At an individual level, I really like the, and I recently published an article about the concept or the idea of intentional betting, being an intentional bettor, because I think at the end of the day, that's what we want is if people are going to gamble, do it with some level of intention. Like, you know, you're not just making these sort of one-off bets in the heat of the moment without any forethought put towards how much you can afford to lose or, you know, that sort of thing. But it's all the same. I don't want to harp too much on language. Where was I going with that? Coming back to your main question, there are some industry personnel that are very invested in responsible gambling and really do want to do the good thing. You know, whether that be from a public relations standpoint, whether it be from a player sustainability standpoint, right? Like research has now shown that if you can, players that engage in RG are more satisfied at the end of the day with their gambling session and are more likely to come back, right? And so if you want a sustainable, healthy player base, which again is another buzz term in the industry, then you want to invest in RG and responsible gambling initiatives or programs. It's also, I think, investing in RG is, it not only protects the player, it protects the industry as well from a social license standpoint, from a, your industry standing out from the illegal market, which doesn't have these protections, right? And so there is a serious paucity or dearth of research on RG. It's a relatively new field. From what I've seen, the industry is hungry for research. They want to do it. They don't know how to do it. And a lot of what my job includes is education onto what research is and why it's important. But once you explain that to them, they're invested and they want to know more. And they come to our conferences. We have an annual conference on gambling addiction. It takes place before G2E every year in Vegas. That's where our headquarters is as well, is in Las Vegas, Nevada. And yeah, we've seen the population of attendees has shifted. Now there's a lot more industry personnel coming to our conference to find out like what's the latest and greatest in terms of research on RG. What can we learn from it? What can we implement it? And I try to encourage when I when I'm talking to presenters, I encourage them to talk about the so what and the now what of the research, right? Because that's the big question, right? You did a publication, great, good for you. I say that's a good start, but so what? And now what? What can you do with the research and what are you going to do next? And how can we get that research into the hands of the people that can use it? And this is a field that I'm particularly attuned to. Previous to my role at ICRG, I was a knowledge broker, knowledge mobilization specialist, which is a fancy way of saying getting the right knowledge to the right people at the right time in the right format to influence something, right?
You did
and
that,
so
at GRIO, right?
So yes, which was OPGRC.
You can mention that. What's GRIO? What do they do?
Yeah. So GRIO came out of it was the Ontario Problem Gambling for the OPGRC, the Ontario Problem Gambling Research Center, which funded research in Ontario and Canada, which then became GRIO, Gambling Research Exchange Ontario. Which was focused on knowledge mobilization. So doing that work, using the existing research, not only in gambling, but even outside of gambling to inform policy programs, initiatives, what have you, in Ontario and Canada, and is now shifted even further to be GRIO in general. They just go by GRIO now, and they're doing that internationally, right? And they're doing that. They do a lot of work with the UK and the Gambling Commission in the UK, really trying to inform best practices for RG by taking the research and synthesizing it, pulling out the golden actionable nuggets, right? And putting them into practice or making recommendations. And, you know, as I mentioned, the field of gambling research is relatively recent compared to other fields like alcohol and even cannabis research. But so there's this tendency to want the research to be perfect before it informs policy programs or initiatives. I say, let's not let the perfect be the enemy of the good, right? If you're going to make a decision, if you're going to make a policy decision, let's say, would you rather be based on some evidence even if it's rather limited, or no evidence at all, or a hunch. You know, I would argue that it should at least be informed by the existing evidence or the evidence in other fields that are applicable. So that's where, you know, it's hard sometimes doing knowledge mobilization to be making sort of concrete or absolute statements given the state of the literature and the state of the research. But you can at least point people in the general direction that the research is going, right? There's a body of evidence in a lot of these fields that exists that is pointing to some conclusion. And so you can give people that. And you can say, this is the current state of the evidence, right? Here's what it suggests. Now, in making your decision or your whatever, your policy, at least now it can be evidence-informed, right? You can take that into consideration. Now, research evidence isn't the only type of evidence that goes into making a policy decision, right? There's multiple types of evidence. And what counts as good evidence, or what counts as even evidence to people, that's defined by that person. It's defined by the end user, right? So some people don't consider research evidence to really be a valid form of evidence because it doesn't answer sort of the complex questions that can come up in policy design, right? It's more, especially when you're doing something like a experimental design or an RCT, it's very stringent, it's very controlled, and it answers very specific causal questions in a very specific way, which may not be absolutely applicable to these sort of complex questions that industry or regulators have to deal with. But it can at least be informed, right? And so that's what I really, and we really aim for at ICRG is funding research to produce that evidence, which can then be translated at conferences. We have webinars. We want to start doing more white papers, you know, to really put that evidence out there, get it into the hands of those that use it. You know, we also have, you know, I would say, if you ask me, like, what do I do? Like, what's my job? I'd say about a third of it is dealing with the research, right? So research calls, doing the peer review process, which really follows like an NIH style peer review process with multiple peer reviewers. It's a whole process that can take a long time, sometimes months, to get all the researchers and peer reviewers in the room to review the literature. And that goes out. And then, you know, once the literature's out, then you got to make a contract and agreement. And then there's a bunch of research oversight and legal and financial accountability. And so that's a third of my job is all everything to do with sort of research granting and the granting process and the calls. The other third is really around the education, right? So our conference, our webinars, we have one-off events, we have regional conferences as well. We're planning an upcoming conference, I believe it is in June, that will focus on lottery, right? And RG in lottery, because there's not a lot of evidence for that. And in a lot of ways, lottery is different structurally from other forms of gambling. And also the characteristics of players are a lot different. And so a lot of the RG initiatives that have been created don't sort of flow into lottery quite as well or fit as neatly. And so really, we're going to have a conference really focused on that. Like, what do we know about RG and lottery, and what can we take from other fields and sort of build on that? So that's another third of my job. But the last third, and I think, and this is getting back to my point about knowledge translation mobilization, sorry, I tend to go on tangents, but is around talking to people, right? And making connections and informing them of the research that we're doing, right? And making those one-on-one personal connections. And honestly, that's one of the best ways we can do knowledge mobilization translation is person to person and finding out, like, what are your needs as an operator, as a regulator? Like, what do you need to know? Oh, you're interested in this? Here's some research that I know about, or here's some research that we've done, or here's a researcher you can talk to, right? And go talk to them. And I can make those connections either between people and people or people in research. Or even industry to industry, right? If I know, because obviously a lot of our donors are from the industry, and they talk to me about what they're doing in RG. So if I can make the connections industry to industry, I can do that as well, business to business, right? And so, it's an interesting job. I really enjoy working at ICRG. I've only been here, I guess, a year and a half, actually a little over a year and a half now. But I love the gambling sector, just due to the complex nature of the problems that we're trying to address. And I think in RG, we're all trying to work directionally in the same direction, but we go about it in different ways, which is fun because sometimes, you know, the left hand doesn't know what the right hand's doing. And if you, as a broker, as a knowledge broker, which is part of what I was before, you can make those connections and you can put people in touch and you can show the connections between people and research. I love doing that. Like that's, you know, that's my bread and butter. Sorry, that was a lot.
So, it's okay.
Yeah, I think, I mean, the what you mentioned before, the lottery conference, is it online or is it a webinar?
Yeah, no, we're still coming together on that. It will be in person. It'll probably be the first week or maybe even the second week of June. We haven't ironed out the details of that one just yet, but stay tuned on our website and our newsletter, right? If you want to be added to our newsletter, you can just go to the website and contact us and say that you want to be added, but we'll put that out when that's out there. And then you'd also get notifications if you're a researcher when there's new research opportunities as well. So that's always great. But yeah, I think, you know, that's just, and again, that idea came from conversations that we've had with people that have contributed from the industry, from the lottery industry, that have said, like, you know, we would love to do more research on lottery and we'd love to know what's out there because we're trying to build our responsible gambling programs and education for lottery. And we don't know, like, there seems to be, again, this lack of research specific to lottery, and we don't know what we could take from where, what we should take, how we should be framing messages. And so, yeah, that's, you know, through the conversations that you have with people, you identify the needs and the gaps that research can fill, and then you do your best to fill them.
For me, gambling research has something very specific about it. And that's to do with the online gambling, doesn't it? Because compared to lots of other, you know, interesting research subjects or, you know, addictions, substance and non-substance, you can observe the individual in their natural environment. You can analyze their behavior. You can track, you know, every click, every move, every game played, and you can learn a lot about how they behave. Because before you said, you know, and I absolutely agree that often research is very controlled, and it has to be controlled because that's what it's about. You know, you have a hypothesis, you want to evaluate that hypothesis or that research question, and in order to do that, you have to get rid, you know, of all factors which could sort of dilute the results. And then, you know, sometimes or often you can't, the results are not valid, academically speaking, because you cannot, you know, they don't replicate reality. So what, for example, there's been lots of, you know, a couple of papers with, you know, for example, when players gambled in a lab, in a laboratory setting, like in a research lab, you give them whatever, $10. And when they are down to the last dollar, you ask them, you know, would you stop or continue? You know, they stop. But in reality, they won't stop, especially if they have gambled for hours or, you know, spent thousands of dollars. So, and all of that, you know, can be really studied and very uniquely so, I'd say, in online gambling, because the individual is there in their natural environment. You can manipulate conditions. And how do you emphasize this type of research at the ICRG?
Yeah, I think that's definitely a major focus going forward. I see a lot more research coming down the line that is focused on online gambling specifically, or even sort of omni-channel presence, right? Like, how does somebody that has both online accounts and gambles in person, like, what, you know, do they start at one and move to the other? Like, what comes first, chicken or the egg type scenario? And does it matter which type of gambling? Like, maybe people prefer to play, I don't know, poker in a brick and mortar casino, but then prefer to do sports betting online. I don't know. You know, we'd have to do research to figure that out. But I think that's really interesting. you know, in terms of the generalizability or the external validity of research, you're absolutely right. I think, you know, so my research back when I was doing my PhD and postdoc was with Dr. Michael Wohl, and we had a gambling lab that really, it did try to recreate as much as possible a real gambling environment. We had sounds playing in the background of slot machines and wins and that sort of thing. And we had the neon lights and the carpet and poker tables, and the slot machines that I used looked exactly like real slot machines. But unbeknownst to participants, you know, I had pre-programmed those so I could control the outcomes of the wins. But, you know, the question still remains, right? One of the more difficult pieces of doing experimental laboratory research is that from an ethics standpoint, you can't, I mean, there's some ways to try to get around it, but at least in North America, from what I understand, you can't have participants, like students, come in and spend their own money and lose their own money gambling, right? Ethically. And so what I did when trying to do that was I emailed them a voucher beforehand, and they had to bring the voucher in for, you know, for our gambling lab. And then I cashed it in and I said, what you leave with, you get to take home with you, which was true. But it's still, you know, the question remains, do people feel like they're playing with the real money, that their own money, you know, like how would their behaviors differ if it was their own money that they brought in and not this voucher that I emailed them that they had to bring in. So, we try to address that problem as much as possible, but it's still a very valid concern. You know, having said that, the experimental lab is only one of the only places where you can really sort of control the variables, the confounding variables, to really determine cause and effect. So I would say there's still... there is still a lot of worth to doing experimental research designs in a laboratory, but online environments do give us that that added benefit of it recreates how they're naturally gambling on their computer, right? Like if you can give them a gambling task or gambling tasks that look exactly like, you know, what it's like when they actually gamble on their computer, then the external validity is sort of increased there. You still run into some issues. Now, you talked about with online gambling, and I would argue with some net now, especially in Australia, with the accounts-based play and tracking, you have the ability to track people in real time and data on their individual bets, their individual movements. And so in that sense, I think data is, and the data that the industry holds or regulators hold in some cases, is extremely valuable for research. Because it's telling you what they actually do, right, in real time. And so you can look at patterns in that. You can use sort of algorithms to determine, like, you know, when does somebody's play maybe move from being intentional to not intentional, right? Or when do they, you know, system one to system two, the slow versus fast system in terms of thinking, like, does that change, or how can we ensure people stay in a reflective state and aren't just sort of betting on whims or getting into trouble? I mean, there's a lot of untapped potential with online data and industry data. Now, having said that, there's been a long debate about whether researchers could or should collaborate with the gambling industry, right? So, some argue that sort of any engagement is inappropriate, right? And they compare it to relationships with, you know, alcohol, tobacco, or pharmaceutical companies, that researchers should not work in any way, shape, or form with the gambling industry. And that concern is understandable, right? Like, industries with vested interests have historically influenced research agendas in ways that undermine public health. And at ICRG, you know, our firewall ensures that separation. But I still get that there can be some concern. And we've had applications, we do have applications that have been funded, where the researcher is partnering with the industry to either access their data or use their infrastructure to test interventions. And in that case, as long as it's done with transparency, as long as it's done, you know, with integrity of the researcher, and we don't fund any research that doesn't meet sort of minimum criteria of rigor, then, you know, I don't see a problem with it, you know, as long as it's fully disclosed, you know, where they got their funding, from us that it's not influenced by the industry, but they did, they are partnering with an industry, and here's what they got from the industry, or here's how the industry contributed to the research design or agenda. I think personally, you can minimize bias. Now, gambling is different in a lot of ways from alcohol and tobacco, right? Because gambling, as you mentioned, especially online, is direct to consumer, right? They're present at the exact point of consumption. So operators and industry are in a very unique position to implement protective practices in real time, which is the real appeal of, I think, the online market in some ways. And so, you know, there's really, I think, four factors that separate the gambling industry from other industries like alcohol or cannabis or, you know, whatever, pharmaceutical. One is, like I mentioned, the point of consumption. So, you know, the gambling operators host the activity themselves, you know, and they can enable safeguards directly to into the experience. Because they're at the point of consumption, they have the data access. So the gambling operators hold this rich behavioral data, you know, like deposit patterns. They have like time spent playing. They can look at things like even loss chasing. If you had the algorithms, self-exclusion usage is a big one that has been used for a long time. So, and with the right safeguards, I think sharing this data with researchers allows for evidence-based prevention and early intervention strategies to be developed by the researchers using that data. The other one, I think, which is probably the most important, is that gambling, unlike cigarettes or alcohol, gambling products are rapidly and adjusted. They exist in a dynamic environment. So, you know, because of that, RG can also be dynamic though, right? It can use algorithms, pop-up reminders, deposit limits.
Yeah. One thing, let me quickly hook in here. So you're right. And just, you know, when you said, you know, so it's direct to customer, of course, you know, as, you know, compared to alcohol or tobacco. However, most gambling operators are not the product developers, right? They are merely brands at the end of the day, right? If you look at for the land-based casinos or the online casinos, the games come from game studios. And that's interesting, you know, because of course, you know, the person consumes the product there in the Las Vegas casino or online with 777.com or whatever, you know, operator there is. But interestingly, you know, the games are supplied by somebody else. They, of course, have access to the data, I think, you know, or probably. And that's also interesting research, you know, point of view, because on the one hand, of course, you can research everything about the individual, like you said before, right? Responsible gaming, player protection. I also heard the terminology participant protection, because let's say I don't, you know, play the lottery, but, you know, my friend plays the lottery and that impacts me negatively. So I'm somehow a participant, but, you know, only indirectly. So, and the point I'm trying to make here is a lot of the research is really individual driven, right? It's about the person. Okay, you know, how do people use limits? I mean, do limits actually help? Should limits be voluntary? Should they have to set a limit, but they can set any limit they want? Or how do they use self-exclusion? How do they, you know, does self-exclusion help? What about reality checks, etc., etc., etc.? But very little, actually, I mean, and I say very, very, very little is about the product. I mean, the actual, if you want the drug, you know, I mean, because the product, if we translate it, you know, try to, you know, sort of draw this analogy to the cannabis or to the alcohol, is the drug that the gambling operator is selling. And very little research is about that. I mean, there are maybe maximum eight academic publications, probably not even eight, which have analyzed structural characteristics, game structural characteristics, using actual player tracking data from online casinos or card-based, land-based casinos, slot machines, BLT terminals. On the other hand, we have probably thousands, maybe tens of thousands of publications which are about the individual. You know, why does somebody gamble? Then, you know, with biological aspects, psychological aspects, comorbidity, prevalence, etc. Why do you think this is the case that so little research is focusing on the product? And, you know, we discussed this before, I think 2 weeks ago, with somebody. Okay, could there potentially be a product which is super, super, super profitable, super attractive, but it wouldn't create, you know, any addiction? You know what I mean? And why do you think, or do you at the ICRG see more, you know, applications coming in about, you know, focusing on the product, or would you say this is more, this is kind of, you know, a side topic?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, you know, this sort of feeds into what I was talking about, that, you know, it is a, gambling is a dynamic. So the third factor was that, you know, unlike cigarettes or drinks, gambling products can be rapidly adjusted. And so it can be difficult to then, especially with game characteristics and them changing between games and new games coming out, can be difficult to get that data. And it can be difficult to then analyze it. And what does it mean? And what are the specific characteristics that are leading to harm that don't lead to harm? And in what environments? And right, and it's not even just about the game or the product itself. It's the product within the environment. And then is the individual there by themselves or with friends, right? And so the context matters a lot, especially in gambling. And yeah. And how people experience risk and reward differs greatly depending on if they're doing it solo, on their computer, in an environment with flashy lights and a lot of cues. But, you know, gambling is not just, and this is my fourth way that it differs, is that gambling's not just consumable, right? It's a designed environment of risk and reward. So this is exactly what you're saying. It, in some ways, gambling as a sector is more akin to financial services or gaming than it is traditional substances like alcohol or tobacco, you know? So regulation, product testing, collaborative oversight are really critical to protect players, just like that kind of protection is essential in the financial market, and I would argue in the gaming market as well. Now, why don't we see a lot of research on that sort of built environment and the context? Part of it is because of the history of the gambling research, which tended to be in the domain of psychology, which of course focuses on the individuals, and then it went to neuroscience, which of course focuses on the biology of the whole thing, and then treatments at the individual level. So there's a lot of factors that pushed the research, at least in the history of gambling research, to be individual. That's changing, right? Off the top of my head, critical gambling studies, critical gambling issues, which takes a more sociological approach to this whole thing, right? Really looks at patterns and behavior and the built environment. I think a lot of behavior change and behavior design theory, like nudges, focus more now on the environment and how subtle changes to decision making or the built environment can influence then behavior. I think there is an increase in research that's coming through ICRG that really does look at that, right? That is really looking at sort of product design. So we have some studies looking at like slot machine features or reinforcement schedules, some research done on audiovisual cues, immersion, which I think is fascinating, right? Is it dissociation or is it flow? You know what I mean? Like when people play a slot machine versus poker, right? Like how do you measure immersion? What does that look like? How does that differ from just blanking out or zoning into something, zoning in versus zoning out? I think that's fascinating. But there is research going on at ICRG looking at sort of those sort of structural characteristics and environmental cues and looking at using experimental design paradigms to examine how the cues influence the intensity and or persistence of somebody's gambling behavior. But that being said, you're right. It doesn't, it's not, I don't think it's not the norm, and it's not what psychologists are used to. But I think we need to look at that more, especially in light of the convergence of gaming, gambling, and digital media, right? We need to research and map how gaming-like elements in games or digital platforms shape risks, shape behavior. You know, we need to look at, research needs to look at gambling from a community standpoint, like community analysis, maybe using like digital ethnography or large-scale behavioral data, I think would be really important. And then how does this all differ when you bring in things like crypto, blockchain, or metaverse, right? Like, how does decentralized gaming or token-based wagering or sweepstakes or even prediction markets now, virtual worlds, you know, once you have anonymity and youth exposure, and you combine that with regulatory blind spots, because regulation is always sort of, I think, chasing the gambling sector, unfortunately, instead of leading it, how does that all come into play to then predict gambling harm? That it's wide open. It's a wide open question. We need more research, and we need more researchers, right? I think part of what ICRG does is we try to fund the next generation of gambling researchers. But I know at least three gambling researchers in the U.S. that have left the sector because it's hard to get. There's no federal funding in the U.S. For gambling research, or very, very little. And so, you know, not a lot of people want to go into the gambling research. And when they do, they can't find the grants to sustain it. And they end up leaving, right, for something else, right? Because soft money is difficult to come by. So there's also the problem of ensuring the next generation of gambling researchers to do the type of research that we need. And so ICRG is one of the only nonprofit funders of gambling research, especially in the U.S. There are some others, but, you know, we're the biggest for sure. And so, you know, how can we do our due diligence in ensuring that we have enough researchers to apply for the open request for applications and proposals that we post? Part of that is just bringing in the money, right? Researchers will go where the money flows. Unfortunately, it's not a lot of money right now in the gambling research. Having said that, we've done a lot of great work over the past, you know, 3 or 4 years to bring in substantial funds.
Does the money actually, the research money kind of grow with the revenues? You know what I mean? Like in the U.S.?
Yeah. It's proportional.
Proportional. Okay. Yeah. Because I just, you know, submitted a paper, and in the paper I am comparing several countries' online gamblers, like you're using a couple of, you know, online casinos, and I'm trying to trace that back or relate it to the country's specific regulatory aspects. You know, like for example, in the US, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, there is not as out of the how many, well, I think it's four who have now, or five, six who have introduced online casinos, and 32 with online sports betting, and none of them, like not a single one, actually requires the license holders to offer players limits. You know what I mean? Like, they can do it, but they don't have to do it. Whereas if you look at most Western European countries, limits are not only have to be there, but players have to have a limit. You know what I mean?
Because
we know, I mean, you emphasized it before, that if individuals, players are engaging with our cheat tools with limits, you know, they play more responsible. Their, player lifetime is even extended. So it has a multitude, you know, of advantages go beyond actual responsible gaming. But yet in the US, not a single of these states requires their license holders to offer their players limits, which for me is like the basic requirement, right? You know, before I think about nudging or predicting or identifying problem gambling or any fancy AI stuff, I mean, this is like, you know, okay, do I have, you know, an outhouse or the toilet in my apartment. You know what I mean? It's not like something we should discuss. This should be complete, you know, standard, you know, basic standard, standard, you know, quality of life feature. Just like I think every operator should have, you know, should offer players limits, and they should make sure everybody has a limit. Because I think last year when I was at G2E, I saw like a, you know, advertising by an online casino operator, and they proudly said that like 7% of their players had limits, and I was like, what? I mean, it can't be. I mean, everybody has to have a limit, you know what I mean? Not just 7%.
Yeah, and I do think a lot of people engage in sort of limit setting without explicit tools either. I mean, this is part of the thing. It's like regulation in some ways stipulates the minimum standards, and so is there a race to the bottom, you know, among operators. You know, regulation is not my specialty, but I was at the International Association of Gaming Regulators conference, last conference, which was in Toronto. And there it really seemed, you know, there was a lot of focus on the illegal market. And I think, you know, there is the paternalism paradox where, you know, too much regulation, a lot of some regulators equate,
of course,
regulation strength with regulation effectiveness. And stronger regulation in some ways can push some people to the illegal markets, right? So the Netherlands right now reports that illegal gambling now outweighs legal gambling after they increase the regulation. Some other examples, I think the UK's reduction of fixed odd betting terminal stakes to £2 was intended to curb losses, but there's some indication that players shifted to other forms of gambling, especially online, where the harm minimization tools vary and regulatory oversight's more complex. And Spain too, I think, saw that, you know, they did sweeping restrictions on gambling advertising, which was designed to reflect sort of a stance on gambling's visibility, making sure that it's not in people's faces, right? And we've heard a lot of that, you know, in North America as well. But what it did is it limited consumer awareness of what actually the legal regulated operators were. And so people were going to illegal operators and offshore operators, not knowing that they were illegal because they looked the same in a lot of ways. And research shows that players can't tell the difference. But so, I mean, you know, there can be unintended negative consequences of mandatory RG. And so there's not enough, in my opinion, research on the effects of regulation, right? I would argue for a regulatory sandbox approach where you try out these different regulations and standards of RG and you test them in real time, right? In specific markets or in limited markets to try to see like what's actually going to happen here. And too often, I think regulation is reactive and restrictive. And because of that, there can be some, even though people want to do good work, you know, there can be
difficult, especially with the internet, because I mean, if you ban, I don't know, you know, cannabis or alcohol, then okay, you know, there are only so many options what people can do, you know, they can travel, they can get it. But with gambling, I mean, you can do it online gambling. I mean, you have an infinite, you know, number of opportunities that and you can exploit as a player, and it's very hard, you know, to really ban it or limit it. But what you're saying is, I think what you see, like I totally agree with you with the lack of research here. I mean, you can, you know, and also, for example, there is very little comparative research because, for let's, you know, the Netherlands has super examples. So they introduced online gambling in October or July 2021. And then, of course, there was online gambling before. It was kind of tolerated or not. And then over the course of these 4 years, they subsequently introduced more restrictions. Like, okay, less advertising, more limits. Now there is like a mandatory monthly limit for young adults and, you know, adults from 25, I think it's like 700 euros. I mean, you can increase it, but you have to apply with your operator. And over this time, you can, you know, kind of follow the data feed and see, okay, what's happening, you know? Like, you know, how are people behaving? A super example is during COVID. So there was a lot of discussions, a lot of papers have been written. I wrote like 3 papers about that. Did COVID actually have an impact? You know, I mean, nobody can tell. I mean, that, you know, I think that subject has pretty much died down. Meantime, nobody's talking about it, you know, anymore. But it was extremely hot topic there. And some argued COVID led to more online gambling, you know. Others said, no, it did not. And you know, what and often the picture is quite, you know, complicated. You know, you can sort of reduce it to one kind of message. There is more gambling or less gambling because, you know, it's not that easy because, you know, different player groups behave in different ways. So what, you know, for example, in Sweden, what did the Swedish regulator did, they introduced a weekly mandatory maximum limit of 5,000 Swedish crowns. So what happened is you saw that, you know, players, operators saw many more registrations because there is not a single customer view across all the operators. What happened is that people simply opened up more accounts. You know, they were limited to 5,000 with the one operator they were gambling. So they opened more accounts. So you could say, whew, you know, I mean, COVID led to, you know, more online gambling because suddenly we have many more accounts. Whereas in reality, people just, you know, opened up more accounts to be able to spend more because they were limited to 5,000 with one operator.
You know, us humans are crafty creatures. You impose any sort of ban or restriction on us, we'll find ways around it. I mean, you know, I think like there's just some of the literature. You know? Yeah.
Increase it and, you know, it will find a way to expand in another direction.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, as I said, regulation is sort of not my specialty, but I do know, you know, in terms of RG, there were some thoughts about time limits, but, you know, what people found there is like, if you impose a time limit, as people are getting towards their time limit, they start spending more money because they're like, oh, I'm going to be, you know, I'm going to be kicked off this platform soon. I better spend the rest of it. And so you see this like mass increase in spending towards the end as the time limit gets there, which is what we don't want either. Right. So, yeah, I think, you know, and this is where evaluation, I think, is essential of any RG features and regulation to see, like, what are the effects of this and what can we learn from it, right? We're never going to be perfect. Again, don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good. Try to do good work. You know, use the evidence to inform whatever policies you're making in the best way possible, but, like, do the due diligence of then following through and evaluating what those effects would be and are. You know, I think at the conference, one of the things that at the IAGR conference, sorry, the International Association of Gaming Regulators conference, I heard there was a lot of talk about what do we do about the illegal markets? Like the illegal market seems to be growing. If, you know, there was a lot of talk about blocking certain sites, and then people are, you know, some regulators are saying, you know, if we're blocking hundreds of sites, but like new ones, with just like very similar names, keep popping up. It's like whack-a-mole, you know? Mm-hmm. And so there seems to be an enormous effort invested into enforcement right now of the market, like domain blocking, payment bans, affiliate crackdowns, cease and desist orders, that sort of thing. But it struck me that there was no real talk of the other side of the coin, right? Like there was enforcement of the illegal market, but that's just half of the equation. The other half is demand of the legal market. Like what is causing people to go to the illegal market, and what's the demand side of the coin, and how do we address that? Right? Because you don't want people moving there because the regulations are so lax. And so like, how can you then improve the demand for the legal regulated markets? And I think right now regulators are scared that by putting in too many, regulations that aren't optional, they will push people to that. That's just my sense. I mean, I'm not a regulator. I don't, I do talk to regulators, but I mean, I don't ever pretend to be one. I'm a researcher by nature. I call myself a recovering academic in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? But yeah, I think, you know, we need to, I think regulated operators need to increase their value. They need to, you know, understand, they need to balance incentives. They need to put in public trust marks. They need to design smarter RG, you know, replace rigid limits with customizable tools that empower people, not just restrict, and do sort of those behavioral campaigns, right? Like to encourage people to play on those like regulated markets that are safer and they can get their money out of when they put it in, you know, and they have some sort of somewhere to go if things go wrong or awry. Yeah. So anyway, that's my thoughts, but I don't pretend to be in the regulation space.
Good points. Couldn't agree more. What do you think, John?
You know, I always agree with you, right?
Well, not when we speak in secret.
No, of course not. But I wouldn't want to undermine you on a public platform. I have too much respect for your doctorate.
No, don't. I mean, PhD, doctor. I mean, I'm always scared of putting doctor in front of my name. If I ever go on a plane and there's an emergency, the best I can do is get, if someone's having a heart attack, I can get them to fill out a questionnaire about gambling harms and maybe determine, you know, what level of PG they're at. But, you know, that's...
Do you feel bad about your gambling?
Yeah.
I think you got to push through the crowd. Let me through. I'm a doctor. And then kneel down next to them and just say, do you gamble?
Well. I can't help you. Especially when you fly out from Las Vegas, right? the chance of somebody having a heart attack is probably quite high.
Yeah.
Maybe I can talk about a little bit about like what are the current research trends that I see, you know, at ICRG in terms of our funded research and what some of those future trends might be. If that's of interest.
Yeah, that would be
excellent.
Yeah, do you want to ask the question so you seem smart and then you can cut out that previous part? Or
anybody that's ever heard anything I've been on will know that I'm faking.
Aren't we all? Yeah, so,
ask yourself an answer. You know, we're good.
Yeah. No, I can talk a little bit about the current research trends at ICRG. I mean, from what I see coming in and what we've funded, one of the obvious foci of research is youth and emerging adults. So, you're, you know, we're funding some large scale longitudinal studies, focus on like, what are the risk pathways for emerging adults, you know, genetically, environmentally, digital exposure, sports betting trajectories, that sort of thing. We're funding some research on that. We're looking at the gambling workforce in terms of mental health and training. So how does working in the gaming industry or the gambling industry affect employees? And how can we sort of how can we provide supports for them, right, in terms of reducing risky, problematic play and increasing their mental health? There's a lot of research on RG messaging, communication. So studies doing sort of co-design with people who gamble, people with lived experience, looking at message clarity, framing, fatigue, behavioral influence, that sort of thing. Going back to the ones on the research on youth and emerging adults, there's a lot of research focusing on sort of comorbidity and mental health, right? So when you get a gambler, it's very rare that problem gambling is their only issue, right? It's comorbid, I think over 90% with something else, whether it be another addiction or mental health or PTSD or substance use. And the question is, what comes first, right? Is it the chicken or the egg? You know, does gambling precede, you know, other comorbid conditions, or do other comorbid conditions like depression cause people to start gambling for relief? And so we are funding some research looking at trying to answer that question, doing temporal mapping and network analysis and that sort of thing. Another big topic is AI, data science, using real-world financial behavioral data, open banking data, operator data to look at sort of financial vulnerability, look at loss chasing. I talked about some of the research that's working on product design, but there's also on the individual level, new treatments, right? So we funded some research looking at psilocybin, so magic mushrooms, or the psychoactive ingredient magic mushrooms, GLP-1 agonists, which are really, that's like Ozempic, GLP-1s. that one's really interesting to me because my PhD research and postdoc research was actually looking at ghrelin. Not to get too much in an aside, but ghrelin is the hunger hormone. So when you're when you haven't eaten, your ghrelin levels go high, and then when you eat, your ghrelin levels decrease. And so what I found in experimental design was that when ghrelin was high, not only do people eat want to eat more, but they also crave other things. And so they gamble more in the face of continued loss than people that aren't hungry. So I guess my summary from 6 years of my life is eat before you go to the casino. You might spend a little bit less, I guess. But
that's a super recommendation. I mean,
right? Yeah. But that's not surprising in a lot of ways. I mean, Gamblers Anonymous has always had this thing called HALT: hungry, angry, lonely, and tired, as the four situations in which relapse might occur, and to be very aware of that. But it was always interesting to me that hungry was one of them. And so GLP-1s, what we have anecdotally reported, people on Ozempic don't crave as much. And from what I understand, again, I'm not in the field anymore looking at GLP-1s, but one of the ways that GLP-1s might work is through attenuating ghrelin, right? So that you don't get those ghrelin spikes and as well. So, anyway, that's all to say that research is going on that. And then brain injury models, really, to understand, like, if there's brain injury in certain areas, how does that then relate to gambling and gambling behavior, and trying to understand then what's the implications from that in terms of treatment and beyond therapy, right? And so this might be like magnetic cranial stimulation and transcranial stimulation, those sorts of things. And then on that treatment thing, there's also like some research like on VR interventions and contingency management, which is one that we funded, which is fascinating to me. It's been shown to be very effective in other forms of treatment, but hasn't been looked at in gambling. And so we funded research looking at contingency management, which is, again, rewarding people for staying in treatment. You'd think that that was a no-brainer in gambling, but there was a lot of pushback because oftentimes you're incentivizing them with money to stay in treatment. And so they have to complete a certain amount of treatments before getting the reward and that sort of thing. So putting contingency on treatment is contingency management. And then the last one that I'll mention is that we're doing some projects that it's looking at sort of sports betting, bankruptcy, what's population level harms, like what are the impacts of gambling legislation on bankruptcy, rural harms, national public health trends. There's one looking at like crashes and that sort of thing in terms of cars as well, automobile crashes, if I'm not mistaken. So just looking sort of like what are not the individual level harms, but what are the population level harms that can occur from gambling. And so that's, those are not only current trends, but I see those almost as some future trends as well. I don't think we're going to see those decrease, but I can tell you from the applications that have come in that there's been a sort of, there are some new foci or focuses on gambling that we haven't seen before, mostly around sort of that the gaming, gambling, digital media, crypto, blockchain, AI, predictive analytics, automated support, sports betting, all that sort of the complex ecosystem, which is now developing around gambling, and then that might be gambling adjacent, but that constellation of changes and how that impacts gambling behavior. A lot of researchers are interested in looking at that. And then what's the economic and societal cost for those changes, right? Like what's the cost of illness, using a cost of illness model, like people with gambling problems, how does that influence the family, the workplace, the justice system? Where are community level harms? How do we include people with lived and living experience into the research paradigms to look at sort of stigma and pathways into harm and help seeking behavior and recovery and those sorts of things. You talked to Vasilinki already, who's doing some great work on sort of measurement and harmonization of measures for gambling harm. I think that will be a push going forward. I'm really interested in PROMs and PRIMs, which I take from the health sector, patient-oriented outcome measures and patient-oriented experience measures, and making those for gambling, because right now we don't have any good measures for identifying when is RG successful, right? Like, how do you measure successful responsible gambling initiatives or programs? Like, it's very hard to measure. And I thought, you know, taking PROMs and PRIMs from the health literature would be actually a great way to do that, if we could make them, you know, as defined by themselves, you know, did their gambling improve as a result of this RG measure or implementation, I think is a great way of going about it.
But how would you assess whether it improved, like they gambled less or?
Yeah, well, I mean, I do have
about the gambling.
Yep. So, I mean, if you're taking from PROMs from, you'd use the iCHM methodology. There's these methodologies to create data sets for PROMs and PRIMs, but I would say that for patient-oriented outcome measures, things like financial control and strain, I kept to my gambling spend I planned, like gambling bills or debts didn't cause me to skip essential expenses, like time control, craving and urge management, functioning and quality of life, psychological distress and recovery capital, harms to others, and then legacy harm. Those would be the PROMs. But the experiences, then, how did people experience these RG programs? You'd look at, you know, this RG program helped me to have informed choice or transparency, respected, I felt respected and I had dignity. I had timely access to whatever it is, the help or RG. I had perceived effectiveness, that it was effective when I used it, and that it was safe and I was felt in control of the service or product that I was offered. So if you had those as a core set, you'd need to do some sort of a Delphi process to identify what those core sets were, but you could use them across then any sort of intervention in any context, right? Like, they're not specific to online or not specific to sports betting or not specific to X, Y, and Z. They could be applied across the board. And I think that would be great if we had a core set of those PROMs and PRIMs for measuring RG effectiveness.
Yeah, no, it makes sense, because I also see that as one of the biggest gaps, you know, and it all comes really back to what you said before about the regulation. What's their goal ultimately at the end of the day, you know, for nobody to gamble or, you know, nobody to gamble in the illegal market, 100% generalization, not causing, you know, any harm. I mean, somehow you gotta specify what you actually want to achieve. Because regulation is the core of everything, isn't it? I mean, it could be complete Wild West. Okay, we don't regulate, do whatever you want, or I ban it completely. And somewhere in the middle, there, you know, should be an outcome measure that sort of helps me to calibrate. You know, what mark do I want to hit?
Yeah, and you know, in the past, because gambling is research is in its infancy, I think a lot of the early research naively focused on problem gambling rates as a marker of reduced harm or increased harm with RG. And it's like, insofar as you consider RG a form of harm minimization, you wouldn't expect in other fields, for example, harm minimization efforts to affect prevalence rates. Like, you know, would the opening of a safe injection site reduce the incidence of people addicted to opioids? Like, no, clearly not, right? In fact, you might even see an increase. Like, yeah, but like, so, you know, I think, you know, focusing on prevalence rates, thankfully, you know, we've matured, the gambling sector and the research sector has matured to a point where we're no longer looking at that. And there is some great, I think there's a website actually dedicated to mapping all the scales that measure harm, gambling-related harms. I don't know. Anyway, maybe you can link to that on the podcast website. But there isn't a standard. I don't think there's a standard yet, right? People are still using different scales.
But even here, you know, even with regard to prevalence rates, there is no, I mean, standardized you know, approach or recurring, I don't know, you know, assessment globally. So when I, you know, wrote my paper lately, I mean, it cost me days just, you know, to scan the literature. And there is this one paper by a Australian, I think her name is Tran, And she published the most recent meta study on gambling prevalence. And, you know, I mean, in the US, for example, you don't have it, you know? I mean, there's nobody there who would go out and just assess what's the prevalence, what's the incidence. No, it's just, you know, not there. It's not there in the US. It's not there in Canada. The UK, they do it, right? So the UK Gambling Commission regularly, annually, assesses prevalence of gambling, problem gambling in a standardized way. They have changed it lately, I mean, with respect to the type of PGSI that they are using, but at least, you know, you can go back and see, okay. Whether, you know, this is completely, I mean, like you say, you know, you can't assess everything based on prevalence, not taking into account harm, but at least it's there. But for very, 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 very few countries other than the UK, we have like these official statistics. Somebody might do it there. They might use, you know, another panel to which, you know, had a couple of gambling related questions. But the research is very sort of, you know, unstructured with respect to that.
Yeah, I don't know if you read, Dr. Nathan Smith, who works at Cambridge Research Institute, he did, there was an article in the GGB magazine called The End of Prevalence. And he's a epidemiologist, you know, by training, amazing, super, super smart and kind individual. And basically he argues that, you know, prevalence, you know, trying to do accurate prevalence in gambling is not only very cost prohibitive, it's super expensive to do an accurate prevalence rate, but stigmatized, when doing a prevalence rate on stigmatized behaviors like gambling, you don't get accurate rates anyway. And it's kind of a wash, and it would be much better to put money into surveillance rather than prevalence. And to do that, we should start moving to surveillance and surveillance studies. And I really enjoyed his particular article. And, you know, you're right. You know, it's hard to say. I mean, I think some of the first research, obviously, that ICRG funded through Howard Schaefer was a national prevalence study to try to get a sense of what it is, because nobody knew, right? Nobody knew if it was 20% or 1%, right? And so that really helped set the benchmark for what we talk about now. But, you know, has that changed? You know, different jurisdictions that are doing it find very similar rates, no matter sort of where you're at. You know, Singapore has, you know, when they did their whole legalization, they did a world tour trying to find out what's the best and greatest of RG, and they implemented a number of different measures that differentiate them, like third party self-exclusion, those sorts of things from the rest. But they still find very similar prevalence rates of disordered gambling. And so anyway, that's all to say, I mean, you know, I think switching from prevalence to surveillance, or studying specific populations and look at prevalence in those populations, is a more worthwhile way of getting at what we want to do rather than these sort of national ones. But having said that, you know, I think it's just a cost benefit analysis at the end of the day. If we had as much money, if the gambling sector had as much funds as opioids or other substance use, then yeah, I could see there being national prevalence studies, but the cost is just extraordinary.
Well, the media also, they're not speaking as one of them, they're generally not that fussed about looking at how figures are got. They just want the catchy, easy figure. And mm-hmm. you know, and I'm not dissing regulators when I say this at all, because it's an incredibly difficult thing to do. It's an incredibly difficult thing to provide. Like in the UK, they did the problem stats. Well, I'm only speaking for myself, but if I'd changed how these things are calculated, I would have sat on the results and published them when 3 years were done. Because then you can show a correlation or not. You can show a comparison to the old way of doing things, and you can show the new way of doing things, and you can explain why, instead of everybody going, oh my God, there's even more than we thought, or, you know, Hang on, maybe the old way was just really flawed. Maybe this way is better. You know, but what do I know?
It's psychology. I mean, you know, it's like we discussed earlier today. I mean, you know, those are just categories that we think make sense, but maybe in 10 years, 15 years, you know, we think completely different about it.
Yeah.
And if you look at the PGSI, I mean, you can be a problem gambler without actually having problems with gambling. I mean, it might sound pretty weird, but if you look at the 9 items, you know, you can meet the criteria of a problematic gambler scoring 8 points on the PGSI, but you haven't really, you know, said anything serious. So it's not...
Yeah.
You know, it's like, you know, it's not anything related to money, anything related to health, and not even related to harm. So people have to, I mean, I always try to emphasize, you know, when I am, you know, sort of involved in some heated discussion about we identify problem gambling, we predict problem gambling, and, you know, then I always try to first, make them think about what are we actually talking about here, you know? I mean, what could you actually try to predict? So if you want to identify certain individuals using algorithms, what's actually your goal here, you know? Who do you want to identify? Who do you want to stop from doing what they do? And can you actually do it based on the information you have available? So that's you know... It's sort of seen as a very simple data science problem, because if I, you know, have the data and I have a pre-labeled data set, so, you know, I have certain individuals I have labeled, like, okay, they have self-excluded in the past, blah, 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 something like this, then this is a very easy machine learning challenge that, you know, any nitwit can probably today solve with ChatGPT or something like this, but it's actually only 10% is about that, and 90% is about what's my goal. Like you said before, you know, this entire discussion about what do we actually try, what do you want to achieve, you know, where do we want to steer gambling, what do we think is a good solution here for society? That's a question that's not been answered yet.
No. And, you know, in the alcohol industry and in society, you know, the alcohol industry has sort of reached an equilibrium where people can talk about these sorts of things and it's sort of sussed out. Like when you open a new bar, nobody's talking about, oh, is this going to increase rates of alcoholism? That never comes up as a topic of discussion. Yeah. But having said that, you know, there are certain behaviors that you want to discourage, right? And so, you know, you can be a binge drinker. You can binge drink every weekend, every other weekend, and not be a problem drinker, especially, you know, in some college stage individuals that I knew when I was back at university. I would say they weren't alcoholics. You know, they didn't have alcohol use disorder, but they definitely engaged in problematic drinking behaviors. And so you can, I guess, at the same way, you can engage in problematic gambling behaviors and not be a problem gambler necessarily. And differentiating those two can be very difficult. You know, you mentioned that there are all these different measures that people are using to measure disordered gambling or problem gambling or even gambling related harm. I would say this, in the absence of a perfect measure, would love a perfect measure that accurately captured with 100% reliability and validity the concept. But in the absence of a perfect measure, give me a standardized measure. You know what I mean? Because then I can at least compare apples to apples and oranges to oranges. And without that, especially across jurisdictions, it's just a mess. You know what I mean? Like even statistically, trying to control for that, like, are you even measuring the same construct? Right? Like. Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, the work that that people are doing to try to standardize harm measures, I think is great. I think, you know, part of the reason that the Better Gambling Forum is coming together internationally is to try to come up with some international pillars, if not standards, of RG, or what that might look like, or how do we measure it? That might be questions that we answer eventually. So, you know, it's difficult. It's difficult work. It's not easy. But the only way that we're going to get to that is if we all agree and we move together in the same direction, which I think requires collaboration among different players and different audiences. So I don't know. It's you're asking the million-dollar questions here around what do we do about this situation. And the market still hasn't reached any sort of maturity level. And with how quickly it all changes, how quickly the landscape and the environment let me give you an example. The last big issue that I remember in alcohol was Four Loko, which was a drink which was combined caffeine and alcohol. And within, I think, a couple months, that was banned. And then that was the last like innovation that I had seen that came to the media's attention, at least in the US and Canada, around alcohol. But in gambling and gaming, I mean, it's just every other week is something new. And how do you keep ahead of that as a regulator? I have no idea.
Yeah.
If I knew the answer to that.
Sorry, it cut out.
It's okay.
Okay, you're caught up. Sorry, it glitched.
It's okay. Recording will be fine. If I knew the answer to that, I would not be hosting. Sorry, co-hosting. Sorry, being the comedy sidekick on this podcast.
You would not put up with me.
Yeah,
I would be.
I'd be out of here. I'd be bottling it, and
I would be pixeled out like in that episode of Black Mirror.
Okay. Good to know. Travis, thank you very, very much for joining us. Really appreciate it. It's been a bit of a head fuck as well.
Yeah, sorry about that. I mean, I tend to go off on tangents. A lot of these opinions are my own opinions, not those of ICRG. I just want to put that stipulation in there. I mean, I've been in the sector a long time. I have some opinions of my own that maybe aren't shared by my colleagues at ICRG and or the Scientific Advisory Board, but always happy to talk shop and deal with some of the big questions in the gambling field.
Oh, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks.